This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our broadcast in online Main Street across North Dakota. And today, our plans have changed because yesterday happened. We usually talk with Jack Russell Weinstein. He's a philosophy professor at the University of North Dakota about his upcoming Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life show. And, of course, we were going to do that today, but we're not going to do that because something else happened. And we're going to talk with Jack about political philosophy as it relates to the events that took place in our capital on Thursday, the events that took place in our capital on Wednesday. Jack, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Doug. I'm really happy to be here, although I wish it were under better circumstances.
Let's get your reaction to what took place at the Capitol yesterday, both as a citizen and as a philosopher.
Well, I have mixed feelings because it was tremendously shocking and heartbreaking. It was scary, but at the same time, it wasn't surprising. I was actually particularly moved by many of the media folks who kept talking about how this was so unexpected and how they can't believe this is happening. But this has been predicted for years. There has been a steady escalation of tactics, whether it's behind the scenes pressuring or violence in Virginia. And the fact that on the day when the electoral votes are supposed to be certified, there was a genuine coup attempt is, in retrospect, almost inevitable. So as someone who follows the news, I was horrified but resigned to the inevitability. As a political philosopher, I asked myself, how do the institutions work? Is there staying power? Once we get past the ability of the police to stop or to direct the events, the question is, how does a democracy deal with something like this? And I will say, as an American and as a political philosopher, the fact that Congress was back in session by 8 o'clock last night was very, very gratifying. The fact that the nation can withstand a challenge like this makes me feel better about the institutions than I felt personally in a long time.
Well, North Dakota's delegation, Senators John Hoeven and Kevin Cramer and Representative Kelly Armstrong, have denounced the lawlessness of the rioters and have indeed gone further than that and have called into question the president's behavior yesterday, where he addressed a rally that he had called to Washington. It was a very large rally, many, many thousands of people there, and then literally told them to march on the Capitol.
One of the great questions of both moral and political philosophy is, where's the line, right? What's the place that you can't cross, right? We know that politics is about bending the rules, right? We know that you want to try ways to sort of get into the cracks and push people in a way that maybe they haven't been pushed before. That's part of the system, and that's understandable. And protesters play with that just as legislators play with that. But there's got to be a line that you can't cross. And violence against the state is that line. Historically, this has been described in terms of monopoly of power. What a state has that's special, what a government has that's special, is the final and usually the sole authorization to use force. And what something like this does is take that away. It's not just an attack on private property, which is not justified, of course, and it's not just an attack on individual people, which is not justified. It's an attack on the very government itself and the very system itself. And that makes it special. And that makes it a violation of the fundamental notion that in the end, the state gets to do what we've given it permission to do, which is decide which force is acceptable and which force isn't, and to be the author of that force.
We have a deep political divide in this country, but this divide seems based on something besides differences in political ideologies.
It is different because it's an identity divide. It's very hard to explain all of this in two sentences because a lot of this goes back to what's called the Southern Strategy. around 1980, the Republicans decided that the way to win elections was to play to the South, that if they cultivated the Southern identity, the inheritance of the Civil War, the Jim Crow legacy, but also this self-identification as a rural people and as a different people than the nation as a whole, they would dominate elections. And the Southern strategy has extended decade after decade in more subtle ways, because in 1965, you could publicly complain about African Americans. But in 2010, you couldn't do that without coded language. And so it's become much more subtle. And what ends up happening is that when people disagree on a particular issue, what someone says is, I don't agree with you on guns. I don't agree with you on abortion. I don't agree with you on other things. But what people hear is, I think you're a bad person. I think your way of life is invalid. I think you aren't a real American. And the second it gets to that level, the ability to have rational discussion, the ability to compromise, the ability to find what one philosopher called an overlapping consensus disappears, because they're not attacking your opinions. They're attacking who you are as a human being. And that's very hard to get past.
Well, how do we confront this kind of polarization that's identity-based, that results in people discarding facts for suppositions or conjecture and acting it out?
Well, the first thing we have to do is set the rules of tolerable discourse. We have to commit to the truth. We have to commit to the idea that political discussion can be emotional, but it has to be emotional within a certain range of acceptable parameters. We also have to accept the fact that you have to follow certain rules of procedure. But the other way to deal with it is to recognize that we need each other. We tend to think of the rural America and the urban America as fundamentally separate and in competition. But as any farmer in North Dakota knows, you have these crops, and without cities, without manufacturing processes, without tremendous international trade, your crops are going to go unsold and they're going to, you know, decompose in front of your very eyes. At the same time, every city dweller has to know that no matter how much they can use and create technology, no matter how much they can manufacture and change goods, everything we eat and everything we use is grown first and foremost in a rural area. Once we accept the fact that we are interrelated, that we need one another on profound existential levels, then we can start to engage each other as partners again. And what, frankly, both parties have done, but the Republicans have done it more aggressively, is forget the fact that we are interrelated in these ways, that we are partners. And if we can just figure out a way to talk to one another as people who are engaged in a joint project, not as people who are trying to dominate one another, then we can start the process anew of working together to create a functional United States.
President Donald Trump was nominated for re-election without a Republican platform. Isn't that a foundation for an autocrat?
It absolutely is. It's also, I had a piece that I published before the first election where I also used the word kleptocrat, which means a leader whose purpose is to steal public money and make it their own private money. And we've seen that as well. You know, this is one of the places where philosophy becomes essential to the discussion. Platforms which are boring to read and unentertaining to watch are much more important than the candidates, because platforms establish the agenda. It establishes the goals. It gives someone an ability to look at it and say, okay, here's what the party believes. Here's what the party is going to aim for. Here's how the party is going to proceed. Do I want to, you know, attach myself to this organization. But without that party, what you have is cult of personality. What you have is not, I'm a Republican, but I'm a Trumper. And if I'm just a Trumper, I'm not a Mike Pencer. I'm not a Kevin Cramer-er. I'm not anything else. I'm just a Trumper. And we saw that yesterday because, of course, what was Trump doing? He was telling the mob to attack his vice president, right? He had been saying for a couple days, Mike Pence does not have the courage to stand up to these people. Mike Pence is no longer in my, you know, I don't approve of Mike Pence anymore. You go and you tear him up. You go and you stop him from doing what his job is as vice president of the United States. Now, independent of everything else, that's profoundly shocking, right? The president is telling a mob to attack his vice president. And that's only possible because the allegiance is to the person, not the platform, and the allegiance is to the president and not the country. The president only has power because the president is an officer of the United States and the representative of the United States. I was actually talking to my daughter who was talking about Joe Biden and how Joe Biden hasn't done certain things. And my response was, Joe Biden hasn't done anything yet. Joe Biden is currently an old man who has the luxury of holding a press conference when he wants, right? Until January 20th, Joe Biden's just a guy who has a budget to hire people in the future. The second he is appointed president, this, you know, January 20th at 12 p.m., then all of a sudden he is the personification of the United States, and then he has authority. What Trump did was reject that authority and use brute power and his cult of personality as a weapon to attack his vice president and his and the Congress of the United States.
Almost 4 years ago, I was talking to a prominent North Dakota politician about the fact then that the president's handling of the truth was highly suspect, that he frequently told mistruths or even outright lies. What makes a true believer? You know, what is truth to a philosopher?
You know, this is a really deep and important question, and there are great debates about what truth means that we can't get into here, including whether it reflects, you know, the world as it is or whether it describes a system. And we don't have to worry about that. But something really important happened in the 18th century, and this is the result of a philosopher named Immanuel Kant, which is he invented the notion of modern subjectivity, right? And I'll say this in plain English because it'll be very familiar to everyone who's listening. It's the idea that my experience is unique and you can't see the world through my eyes. You can only see the world through your own eyes, and other people can only see the world through their eyes, and we can never really communicate what that experience is. Now, to a certain extent, that's true, right? How Jack sees the world is fundamentally different than how Doug sees the world, and it's very, very hard without literature, without poetry, without music to describe that experience. But that has been interpreted, especially in the second half of the 20th century, as saying there is no truth, there is only opinion, and there is only belief. And so then what you get is not just this idea that I experience living in Grand Forks in a different way than someone else experiences in Grand Forks, or I feel about an issue differently than someone else feels, but rather that since 2 + 2 = 4 is my belief, if you believe 2 + 2 = 5, it's the belief that's important. It's not the truth that's important. And that combined with the legacy of partisan media, the desire to make money at all costs, the loyalties that are wrapped up in identities and cult of personality means that truth becomes a less and less and less effective tool. That untethers political discussion. Political discussion without a commitment to brute facts becomes a battle of personal preference. And ultimately, going back to this idea of no platform, the people who tried to take over the United States yesterday didn't have any other platform other than keep President Trump in office. We don't know how they feel about healthcare. We don't know how they feel about public schools. We don't know how they feel about funding Amtrak. We can guess how they feel about guns. But that's it. What we know they believe is that Donald Trump should remain in office. That is not even an interest group in a democracy, because even an interest group has a platform, a set of beliefs. All we know is they think that Donald Trump should stay in office. And why do they think that? Because they like him. They tried to take over the United States because they felt like it. And that's tremendously problematic.
Jack, do extremists recognize that they are on the fringe of politics?
It's a great question. And actually, the answer goes back to that subjectivity thing we were talking about and Kant. You know, we always tell people that they're not the center of the universe, right? That's one of the central lessons of adulthood. Well, sure we are. Stand up and spin around. The universe is all around us, right? We are literally, for our subjectivity, the center of the world. And there's no way around that perspective other than to reason and imagine our way through it. It's the same sense for extremists, right? It's not that they know or don't know that they're on the fringe of politics. It's that as far as they're concerned, they're the center and they're right. And because they're right, whatever else unfolds in front of them is just not them. And sure, they may understand that there's most people to the left of them or most people to the right of them, but all that means is that the system and the spectrum is so skewed that it's lopsided because they should be in the middle. And that's one of the fundamental problems in politics, is we think we are the middle and everyone else is to either side of us. But that's because we think we're right. Now, democracy is designed to take that into account, or I should say the American democracy, the legacy of John Locke, which I don't have time to get into, is designed to compete these perspectives, right? These interest groups. But extremists are just like everyone else. They're the center of their own universe. What they don't have is the moderating ability to recognize that they may be wrong.
Jack Russell Weinstein is the host of Why? Philosophical Discussions about Everyday Life. You can hear it this Sunday at 5 Central on our Prairie Public Network. It will be a discussion centered around Jamaican music. Now we're talking about political philosophy. Jack, laws were broken. Lives were lost yesterday. Precedents and traditions were shattered. But there are those who argue we should avoid prosecuting the president through the legal system. They contend that the removal and the indictment of a president could make things worse. How does a political philosopher parse that?
So the first modern conservative was a guy named Edmund Burke, also in the 18th century. Almost all of our political discussions are going to revert back to 18th century and Thomas Jefferson and Adam Smith and Edmund Burke. And Edmund Burke argued, the core of conservatism is as follows. Any change in life is disrupting. And so he was talking specifically about the French Revolution. He said, no revolution is justified because it disrupts life so much that you can never find your footing again, and it destroys traditions. And in itself, everything else being equal, it's good to protect traditions. So if we learn from the conservative worldview, we learn that something like impeaching or prosecuting a president should be a last resort. It's not something that should be easy. It's not something that should be used for a political tool. And I subscribe to all of that. I think that the idea of prosecuting any political figure should happen after a certain number of steps have been taken. But again, to go back to that one of our earlier discussions, there's a line that can't be crossed. And he crossed that line. He tried to take over the United States. And that's treason. It's sedition. And that has to be prosecuted. And so will it make things worse? I doubt it. It might make things worse in the short run. But all along for the last 4 years, as President Trump has broke this little law or that little law, this little tradition or that little tradition, from campaigning in the White House, which no president before him had ever done, to accepting foreign gifts, we've always said, just don't bother. It's only going to make things worse. And when you say that, I mean, look, a lot of the listeners have little kids, and you know that every time you let the little kid go a step further, it means they're going to try another step further, right? Give a mouse a cookie, a glass of milk, and he'll ask for a cookie, or give a mouse a cookie and he'll ask for a glass of milk, right? This is Donald Trump to the T, right? And so we have to draw the line, and we have to say that some things are unacceptable. And in the short run, it may cause a little more chaos and consternation, but nothing is more important than the rule of law. Although I want to qualify that. The only thing more important than the rule of law is the rule of just law. Laws in themselves shouldn't have power because there are profoundly unjust, profoundly immoral laws. But just laws, good laws, moral laws, these have priority over everything. And President Trump may have broken some unimportant laws, and maybe he can get away with that. But he has broken and incited people to break the core laws of the United States. And that can't stand. Because if it does, what's the United States? What makes law special, what makes a law in a democracy special, is that it treats all people equally on some fundamental level. I just want to use another example. One of the things that makes the United States unique in the world, and has made it unique in the world since its inception, is that a person whose family came over to North America on the Mayflower is the same level of an American as someone who was naturalized yesterday. So if someone comes from Colombia and becomes an American citizen, the moment they become an American citizen, they are as much an American citizen as someone whose family has been here 200 years. Why? Because in America, citizenship is a political distinction. It's not a family distinction. It's not a cultural distinction. It's not a sign of lineage. It's a political justification. It's a political idea. Donald Trump is a person. That's actually a technical term in political philosophy, a person. Donald Trump is a person in exactly the same way you're a person, in exactly the same way I'm a person, in exactly the same way all of our listeners are persons. And all persons are subject to the law, and the law does not individuate individual people. It doesn't point to someone and say, this is legal for everyone else but Jack. That's not how the law works. The law is general in nature. And if the law doesn't apply to Donald Trump as a person, then the law loses all moral authority.
Jack Russell Weinstein is a philosophy professor at UND, and we'll get into more of his perspective from a philosophical point of view of what led up to and how we should react to yesterday's assault on the Capitol. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Senator Kevin Cramer says he quickly realized that it was more than a drill as protesters stormed the Capitol. He was in the Senate chamber as debate was underway on Electoral College certification. Cramer says it was clear that something was wrong when there was a rush to remove Vice President Mike Pence from the chamber.
The thing that was interesting to me, and it was obvious, that this was not a fire drill. This was not even just a precaution. This was serious. As we went down some stairs and got down to the lower level, and they told us where we were going, and when one of the officers said, move faster, people, move faster, they're right behind us, it was like, okay, we're not just escaping the bomb threat, we're under siege.
Cramer says President Trump should take part of the blame for the unrest. He says there's little doubt that his words to those gathered outside the Capitol incited people. The Republican, a longtime supporter of the president, says the security breach and lack of pre-planning by law enforcement is a major concern. A lawmaker from Edinburgh has introduced a bill to give the legislature a seat at the table when an emergency is declared, such as the COVID-19 pandemic. Republican Yana Myrdal's bill requires the governor to call a special session if a declared emergency extends beyond an initial 30-day period. The bill says that session could be held remotely using technology.
We felt there was holes in the Sentry Code that didn't allow legislators and local representatives that we are by the people to be part of the decision-making process. Of course, the executive branch has to have emergency powers, but we needed to cap that. And we needed to cap it so that if it extends beyond 30 days or 60 days, we need to be able to come in and work as a government together for the people.
Myrdal says for her, the idea of a one-size-fits-all declaration doesn't work.
You know, a bar in Bathgate is not the same as a bar in Fargo when it comes to closing down.
Myrdal says this is not directed at the Burgum administration or the current pandemic. Rather, she says this is focused at what happens next time. And one part of the new $1.1 billion bonding bill introduced by Republican lawmakers focuses on carbon capture from lignite-fired power plants. The measure would set aside $50 million for carbon capture projects.
We have 800 years of lignite coal in this state, and we do not want to leave it as a stranded asset.
Senate Majority Leader Rich Wardner says the state has a number of coal-fired power plants that are in danger of closing if ways are not found to remove the carbon emissions from the smokestacks.
When they're gone, we will not be able to replace them. And you know who the losers are going to be? The people living here 20 and 25 years from now, because we're not going to have the electric energy and able to meet the needs at that time.
Governor Burgum has proposed a $1.25 billion bonding bill. Democrats have a $2 billion bonding proposal. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for this continuation of our discussion with UND philosophy professor Jack Russell Weinstein about the political discord in our country that resulted in what happened yesterday, the assault on the U.S. Capitol. We have an added complication here, this base, tens of millions of voters whose surveys indicate believe the president's claims of fake news and election fraud. Does philosophy offer a procedure to work through these profoundly different impressions of reality?
Well, I'm going to offer a non-satisfying answer than a satisfying answer. The non-satisfying answer is when we hold to ideas of truth, you say, so what? They believe these things. They're wrong. So what? You're allowed to believe whatever you want to believe. You can believe that your, you know, cat speaks French. Who cares? What you can't do is act on it. And so the Constitution of the United States, the Supreme Court, our laws are very, very specific that we are have absolute 100% freedom of belief. What we don't have is freedom of action. And in between that, we don't have complete freedom of speech. We have more freedom of speech than many places, but not absolute. So the first answer, which is profoundly unsatisfying, is who cares? They can believe what they want. They can't act on it. But the more complicated question is what to do about it and how to restore some sort of base level of knowledge in the United States. And I use the word restore, and it's unclear that this is a new problem, and it's certainly not exclusive to the United States. And the first answer is we have to rethink how media works and we have to rethink how the internet works. But the more foundational answer is we have to rethink education. We have to make sure that people get equal education, that people get good education, and that people get education for citizenship. And what this means is that education isn't about training for specific jobs, or education isn't about getting a degree so that you can show people that you have the proper credential to move on to the next stage of your life. Education has to be about critical thinking. Education has to be about group projects. Education has to teach people how to communicate well and how to listen to others. I'm going to steal a line from, I think it's the West Wing, one of the President Bartlett in the West Wing, where he says, education is the magic bullet. Education has a profound effect on society. And if we teach, let me give you two very basic examples. The first is, we teach the Holocaust as if everything was fine in Germany. Then along came this crazy man named Hitler who threatened people until they participated in the Holocaust. And then Hitler died and everything returned to normal. In the same way, we teach America had a race problem. Along came this guy named Martin Luther King. He persuaded people that racism was wrong. He was killed. Afterwards, his legacy was honored by changing the laws, and now there's no racism. The first problem with those two scenarios is that they're wrong. But the more important problem with those scenarios is that we talk about facts out of context. We don't talk about the history of anti-Semitism in Germany, in Europe, in the United States, and in the world. And we certainly don't talk about the history of segregation and Jim Crow and the legacy of racism that still exists. One of the things that education has to teach is context. And in order to teach context, we have to teach history. We have to teach literature. We have to teach the ways that popular culture reproduces biases and cultural worldviews. And this is really complicated. And it's really complicated. So it takes tremendous skill, tremendous funding and resources. And I'm going to say this as a professional teacher. One of the worst lies and the things that I get the angriest about is when people say, and they're talking about homeschooling, you are your child's best teacher. I'll tell you, my child refuses to learn anything from me at all. Try to teach my child how to, you know, play the piano or get my child to read a book that I think she ought to read. It'll never happen. It won't happen with my wife either. My wife won't read anything I tell her to read either, right? We are not our children's best teachers. Our teachers are our children's best teachers because they're trained to educate and they have the proper background. And so we have to restore this idea that there's expertise, that there's professionalism, that there are people who are worth listening to. And we have to restore the idea that education is an honorable profession that is worth giving a lot of attention and resources and priority to, because the hope is not changing the minds of the current generation. Old dogs can't learn new tricks. The hope is that the next generation and the generation that follows is a more moral, more committed, more energetic generation that can fix all of the mistakes that our generation have failed to address.
We'll leave it with that very weighty hope, I guess. Jack Russell Weinstein is the host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. You can hear it this Sunday at 5 Central on Prairie Public. Jack, thanks for leading us through the weeds again.
Thank you, Doug, as always. And it's nice to be a professional political philosopher on Prairie Public than the goofier role I play on Why. So it's been an honor.
Okay. And coming up on Main Street, we'll really shift gears. We'll have Sue Belcom on with Main Street Eats.
Hi, I'm Cassie Shipley, Donor Relations Coordinator for Prairie Public. If you're a sustaining member, we can't thank you enough. Your generous monthly contribution provides a reliable source of funding so we can bring you high-quality programming and fact-based, independent journalism. Plus, you help bring down the costs of mailing out pledge reminders. And of course, it's greener for the environment. So we know you enjoy the little extra benefit of saving Prairie Public money. But here's where we could use your help again. Expired and renewed credit cards can stop a sustaining membership in its tracks. But that can't happen when you set up your monthly deduction via a checking account. So make the switch. All we need is your bank's routing number and your account number. That's it. So make your monthly gift to Prairie Public count even more by switching your sustaining membership to a checking account monthly deduction. It's easy to do. Just call me, Cassie Shipley, at 800-359-6900, extension 538, or email at sustainer@prairiepublic.org.
Support is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined by Ashley Thornburg and Sue Belcom. It's time for Main Street Eats.
Sue, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's a new
year.
Happy New Year. Sue Balcom joins us from her farm outside of Mandan, the Root Cellars Farm. And speaking of the New Year, Sue, you want to talk about some New Year's resolutions. And I love you. Yours has nothing to do with dieting right away. You're going to do some cleaning? New Year's resolution to clean, huh?
Yeah, it's just kind of a weird thing, and I don't know if it's – I don't know where it ever came from, but I always have this incredible urge to start cleaning out drawers and shelves and things before January. I don't know if it's like a clean start to the year, but the good news is that I have a friend that cleans houses. Well, first of all, I have to preface this by saying when I was about 30 years old, I used to be really German about cleaning.
What does that mean? I know what it means to be very Swedish about cleaning. What does it mean to be very German?
Oh, my gosh. I've heard stories about German women going out and sweeping the streets when it rains in Germany just to keep the streets clean. So I would, like, clean for hours every weekend. And one day, my mother, God rest her soul, said, you know, Sue, I've been cleaning house for, you know, 60 years. I have nothing to show for it. And I'm like, hey, wait a minute. If I quit cleaning now that I'm 30, maybe I will have something to show for it by the time I'm 60. And so I kind of relaxed my rules about cleaning the house. So I only do it twice a year, once in the early year and once in the fall. Really thorough cleaning, you know.
I just got done with a major clean, actually. I reorganized a major storage area in my home. I feel much better about it. And that's why, if you're talking about New Year's resolutions around dieting, exercise is cleaning. Cleaning is exercise.
Right, because dieting is so overrated. I mean, it takes so long for results, but when you clean out a closet or a drawer in your bathroom, it's like instant gratification,
and
right?
And you feel lighter. At least I do in my own body. I'm like, yep, I definitely lost that 5 pounds mentally because I was carrying around 18 bars of soap I'm not going to use, you know.
And I can actually smell the air is cleaner when I do these, let's call them January purges. How's that?
I like that.
But what also prompted this was I went to the pastor's wife one day and I said, Karen, I said, where in the Bible does it say that cleanliness is next to godliness? I, for some reason, can't find that in there. And so she, in all of her wisdom, said, Sue, I think one day a pastor said to his wife, cleanliness is next to godliness, just to get her off his back. And I'm like, oh, boy, and it stuck, too. That's a terrible thing, isn't it? So I decided since God doesn't require me to have a dust-free home, I can, if you can write love in the dust on your television, you're good, right? However, there's the bathroom thing, you know, like, oh, I just hate dirty bathrooms.
Oh, God. What? Yeah. Why would you? Ugh. Oh, can't handle it.
I have a friend that cleans houses for a living. And one day I said to her, I said, oh, my gosh, you know, when a shower is brand new and it's just so nice and shiny, but it's impossible to keep it that way. Mm-hmm. And she told me her secret cleaning ingredients, which I'm very chemical sensitive. And so I try not to use a lot of strong sprays and things you can buy on the market. I like the smell of vinegar myself, but I have this whole big repertoire of cleaning things that you can build yourself, which we can go into if we have time today. But otherwise, absolutely, this is a shower cleaner that is so freaking amazing, you guys. First of all, you need a spray bottle, you know, the kind you can get at Walmart. And then you take and heat a cup of vinegar in the microwave, not boiling, but just get it warmed up. And then mix it with about a half a cup of Dawn dish soap in that spray bottle. Spray it on a dry shower and walk away. Have a cup of coffee. Then come back and clean your shower. And I am not kidding. This is like the best news I've heard in a long time because it really works.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to try this because I actually have that issue with my shower. And I've tried a number of off-the-shelf things. And frankly, I've been disappointed.
Me too. I don't know where it comes from, but on the outside of the shower door, it gets those crusty things that look like lime buildup or something. It even took that off.
I was like,
this stuff is amazing. And so I just save the extra. I pour it out of the plastic bottle and heat it back up again in a glass container and just keep using it. It is just amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, that stuff that gets in your shower head is the same as the stuff that's on the outside of your shower. It comes from the water, the chemicals in the water. And so if this cleaner works on that, I'm going to try it on the shower head.
I've done that before. It does work really well.
So what you want to do then is take that shower head off and soak it in a pail of that stuff.
Yep.
Or soak it in a bowl of that stuff. Makes it a lot easier to scrub out. You can use like an old toothbrush because I save them, of course, to get the little holes cleaned out.
That's the best cleaner, yeah.
We're just kind of thrifty people, aren't we?
We are boring adults, yes.
Boring. Well,
Sue, after you've written love on the top of the TV set in the dust, then you know where to spray and dust, right?
Oh, and you know what? I had to find an alternative to Botan sprays for dusting. My husband brought home this one, and I don't remember the brand name on it, but it said it was for people with allergies. And so I about died. Like, I'm not kidding. Almost anaphylactic shock from this spray. It was that terrible. And yet it was touted to be good for people with allergies. So one day when he wasn't looking, I took it outside and I just shot it into the atmosphere, hoping to God I didn't create a bigger hole in the ozone. And decided to make my own dusting spray, which is in another spray bottle, which you can buy these plastic bottles at a big box store for like $2, and they're awesome. But you only use a cup of water, a quarter cup of vinegar, and some olive oil, 2 tablespoons of olive oil. And then if you want it to smell lemony, which I don't have issues with essential oils as much as I do with perfumes and things, you can put a little essential oil in there, but it's not necessary. And then all you do is shake that up and spray it on your rag. We don't use paper towels unless we absolutely have to. We use rags and we wash them and hang them on the laundry line. But that stuff works amazing for dusting, and it doesn't leave a film behind or make me want to throw up from the smell.
Is there any cleaning in the world that will stop you from needing to dust as often? You know, like, is there anything that repels
dust? Don't move around
dust?
The house.
Do we, yeah.
Keep the
action. Don't have forced air
ever come in the house. I mean, we've changed our air filters. It just...
Furnace filters, air filters, keep your windows closed. Don't use flour. You can't get away from dust.
Okay.
Do you know where most of that dust comes from? You're sloughing your skin cells constantly. And they say that a large part of that dust comes from you yourself. So I don't think there's a way to get away from it. But, you know, we live out in the country. And so we have to scurry when the farmer gets in his field next to us and close everything up because it's been so dry.
Dust.
Yes, there's so much dust.
Yeah, my husband does concrete. And, I mean, honestly, if we wash our clothes together, mine come out dirtier.
Oh, yeah.
Can't do it.
Ooh.
Yeah. Ugh.
So I have a cleaning issue that confounds me, actually. I've got one of those glass top stoves, you know, the induction heating thing.
Get rid of it.
And, I hear you. I wouldn't have bought it if I'd known what I know now. That said, cleaning it is difficult.
So is it just, it's just a regular glass? It's a glass top stove and it gets like these small little scratches in and stuff. You use a razor blade on it, don't you? To get
well, I do have that and it, and it frankly that gets tiresome, but that's what it gets down to. You've got to actually scrape it off.
Right. And that is very important to do right away because one of the worst things for those glass top stoves is sweets. Like if you have milk that runs over or if you're making jelly or jam and that the sugar eats that glass. But I have found that if you sprinkle baking soda over the top of that and then peroxide, it really does help. It is a chore and they never, ever look as nice as they do when they're brand new. I've been trying for years to keep my oven and my range clean, and I'm like, I'm giving up.
Yeah.
It's just impossible.
I do know someone else who does the vinegar and baking soda and then puts that on a towel, like has a towel mixture.
Right. You make a paste out of it. Yep. Paste out. Oh, she puts the towel on.
Yeah.
It. Interesting. Yeah. And that's a lot of fun. I've always loved to do. I've
a
always
hot,
cleaned.
Wet towel.
Yes. I've with vinegar and but peroxide bubbles more. You know, peroxide eats away at a little bit more. But, you know, I've always had I've always had a garbage disposal. And so one of the things you can do for your garbage disposal is pour baking soda down there with a little vinegar, hot vinegar or hot water. That really helps keep the grease from kind of like clinging to those PVC pipes. There is sudsy ammonia that works kind of the same way. For those kinds of things. And I'm not too fond of ammonia because, once again, that has like an incredible smell to it. But, you know, there's still some benefits to using those kinds of things instead of purchasing that stuff all the time. And window cleaner, of course. You know, people are using Windex all the time. I hate that stuff. It just drives me crazy. When I clean my windows, I actually use soap and water and a squeegee. But if you use water with vinegar and rubbing alcohol in it, you know, the rubbing alcohol will help that water to evaporate. But the key is the squeegee.
Is that what makes it not streak?
Yes. You know, like, so what you want to do is you want to clean your window frames with soapy water and, you know, wipe those off to get the dust off of there. Because anytime you're cleaning your window, if your frame is dirty, you're drawing a lot of that stuff back up there on your window. And, oh, my gosh, mine could use cleaning so bad that I'm thinking I wanted a window cleaner dude for Christmas.
Oh, right. I know.
I didn't
Every
get
year
him,
for
though.
Christmas, I ask for a pony or someone to clean my house. Oh, Come on. Oh,
okay. So on a final note here, guys, really, when you walk into someone's house, it is like totally stinking spotless and there isn't a book or a piece of paper or a pen out of place. Don't you wonder what those people do all day long?
My grandma had a kitchen magnet that said dull women have immaculate houses.
Oh my gosh. And you know, I have a cluttered mind. So every once in a while, I have to unclutter my house. But for the most part, I got projects in every corner. And so when people come in here, they spend half their lives going, wow, what is that?
I don't care at all if my office is a mess and I'm fairly tolerant of my car being messy. But I don't like when my house is a mess. I really don't.
You don't own very much stuff, if I remember correctly.
It does make
Wait
it easier.
Wait till you're my age.
Well, I got rid of a lot of clutter over the new year, and I feel better for it. So now I'm ready to actually do some cleaning because I can see the stuff I need to clean. We check in with Sue Belcom at Root Center Sue every week on Main Street Eats. It's always a pleasure, Sue.
Oh, thank you, guys, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them. This is Dakota Datebook for January 7th. Normally, a New Year's Eve observance means nighttime partying, silly hats, and cautious expectations about hangovers at dawn's early light. But many citizens, getting ready for the year 2000, were hoping there would be no massive ramifications to humanity's reliable companion, technology. By today's date in the year 2000, there was relief that the world's technology had not collapsed. The scare of the calendar change was the millennium bug, with the nickname Y2K. It was born of the idea that computers might fail, unable to adjust their programming because many systems calculated the year with only two digits. What would happen when the computers went from 99 to 00? There was real concern of a mammoth failure. The setting of a new year and a new century arriving with disaster was a science fiction fan's fascination or nightmare.
Warnings of the potential effects included the loss of power, computer systems run amok, or even worldwide blackouts. But on New Year's Day, life went on with passion and joy. New York's Times Square teemed with over 1 million revelers. Their participation was echoed by teams of people across the world at their appropriate times. Potential problems with the century change had been undermined by contemporary technology itself that helped the lights stay on, computers without blowouts, and weapons systems intact. In London, Big Ben's bell pealed at midnight, preceding a glorious fireworks display. 2 million people crammed the streets in central Berlin. Queen Elizabeth kissed husband Prince Philip after toasting the new year with champagne. Don Jones, head of Y2K troubleshooting for Microsoft, said, "Literally, you can count the number of Y2K-related calls we've received around the world on one hand." In North Dakota, the potentially spooky evening passed with no major problems. The new millennium had arrived, and its big, bad boogeyman of fright faded from memory. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Steve Stark. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
I hope that the listeners on Prairie Public tune into the Thomas Jefferson Hour, because I believe that we need to lift the idea of civilization and civility and culture, that we need, in a sense, to rise to the occasion of being what Jefferson had in mind for this civilization, and that the only way to do that is to be self-conscious about it and to work together to create the conditions under which we know we would be happier, more fulfilled, and more enlightened. And I think that the Jefferson Hour, in the broad world of public radio, is an important niche in which that project finds voice and creates a community of people who want to live in a more enlightened world than the one we happen to be born into.
Join Clay Jenkinson for the Thomas Jefferson Hour, Sundays at 11 a.m. Central, 10 a.m. Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org, and after the broadcast or stream, you can find any Main Street show right there at prairiepublic.org. Friday on our show, we'll get an assessment of higher education in the state after a year challenged by the pandemic and the challenges that persist. We'll talk about it with Nick Hacker, chair of the North Dakota Board of Higher Education. Our news director, Dave Thompson, will drop by to talk about the week's big stories, and Madeline will review another new movie. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.